started up in the Institute. And as part of that, he's been working on a rebuilding macroeconomics grant with David Soskis, looking at the connections between globalisation and workers' bargaining power. And also, I've worked with Pavel on a research grant recently, looking at trends, to do some research on trends in spatial income inequalities, which we're keeping our fingers crossed about. And on top of this work he's going to present today, he's recently released a discussion paper at CEP with Brian Bell and Stephen Machin on rent sharing and inclusive growth, which looks at trends and the extent to which firms share profits with workers in the UK. So you've been very busy, Pavel, but I'll hand over and let you talk about this paper.
Thank you so much, Mark, for the introduction, and thank you so much for coming. So I'm from the Center for Economic Performance. That's one floor on the 32th Lincoln Infields. That's where the economics department is. And this is a joint work with Philip Novokmet from University of Bonn and the World Income Database, and formerly he did his PhD at the Paris School of Economics. And in this project, we are looking at the long-run evolution of inequality in Poland, starting at the end of 19th century until basically today. And I should start with some motivation why Poland could be an interesting country for you. So first of all, Polish history is rich in a lot of, in many interesting but also tragic socio-economic and institutional shocks. So maybe I'll just give you a quick overview of the history of Poland since the end of 19th century. So before World War I, there was no Poland on the political map of Europe. Instead, there were three, we call them partitions. So Poland was occupied by three empires, Prussia to the west, Austria to the south, and Russia to the east. So we have three different institutional settings in one ethnic nation. And this lasted until World War I. And you know, World War I was a big war, and Poland was heavily destroyed during that time. But in 1918, Poland was reunified. Then we had a period of relative prosperity, a lot of hopes, investments. Then came the 1930s, and with them the Great Crisis, which hit Poland in a very serious way. We have a drift toward autocracy, and eventually in 1939 we have World War II. Okay, and then another great leveler. Poland was the country which suffered the biggest relative losses in terms of population in the whole world during this conflict. 1945, we have the war is over, but then we have a communism introduced in Poland, which lasted for around 40 years. And in 1989, finally, we have a transition to the democratic and capitalistic system. In 2004, Poland has joined the European Union, as you may have probably noticed here in London with the wave of migrants coming, and including myself 3 years ago. Right, so in some sense, Poland is this kind of laboratory for social scientists. You know, because all of these different things, we have different institutions, we have different policies, many of them very radical, we can then kind of, it's a laboratory to see how institutions are affecting inequality. In particular, I think the recent 30 years are very interesting in Poland. We've been called the growth champion of Europe. Poland has been the fastest economy in Europe since 1989. In fact, we've been growing faster than the famous Asian tigers. This is also a country that experienced reindustrialization, and its share in the world GDP has been constantly growing since the 1989. So you can actually see this progress on this graph. So here we have real income per adult since the 1910 until today. This is Poland, and this is Western Europe, which is basically unweighted average of Germany, France, and the UK. And I think, you know, just few interesting fun facts here. You can see that during the communist time, so this was between 1945 and 1989, Poland was developing. There was economic growth, but it was really lagging behind what's been happening in the Western world. Okay. But then, as you can see, there's several big crises in the communist time, at the end of 70s and at the end of 80s, which eventually led to the collapse of the whole communist system. And since 1989, we have this praised economic growth, and slowly we're catching up with the Western Europe. And you can notice that in the Western world, in Western Europe, this is the effect of the Great Crisis. We haven't experienced any fall in income during this period. We're the only economy in Europe which has not experienced any recession during this time. But at the same time, although we have this, praised growth, we also experienced recently populist backlash. And actually, just two days ago on Sunday, we had another election in Poland, which was won again by the current government, which is the right-wing kind of populist government, and they got 44% of the votes. Right? And you can see that actually a big support for this party comes from the redistribution policies. So they introduced a lot of very generous transfers, family allowances, and also they decreased the retirement age. But it's not just them. All the major parties in Europe were kind of pushing these policies. So you see this kind of somehow a paradox. We have one of the fastest economic growth in Europe after 1989. At the same time, we have a very strong demand for basic redistribution policies, which raises the question whether this praised economic growth has lifted all the boats equally, or whether maybe this economic growth was captured by some very small portion of people, right? So essentially, there's a question of inequality. As you know, I don't have to persuade you why looking at inequality is important. You know, I grew up, especially in Poland, with the kind of perception that you can either have economic growth or you can have equity, right? So we have this efficiency-equity trade-off. But actually, what we rather think now is that you must have growth. To have growth, you must have certain equity. So this famous efficiency-equity trade-off is no longer really true. And so in my opinion, to understand what will be the future of Poland, you must also understand what has happened with the Polish inequality, especially in the last 30 years. And this is the main motivation behind this project. So what we are doing with Filip here, we are drawing the long-run evolution of income inequality in Poland since 1892 until 2015. We combine a lot of data sources, including household surveys, including tax data and national accounts, in order to arrive at homogeneous series which span over the century, so these measures are comparable between the periods, and also they're comparable across countries. And to be more specific, for the entire period, so for more than 120 years, we construct top income shares, and for the last 30 years, we look at the full distribution of income. So we can also say, what was the fraction of income going to bottom 50% or middle 40%, right? So in some sense, we are doing here this what's being called kind of pseudo-distributional national accounts. And just by the way, if you have any questions, just please interrupt me, okay? I prefer it this way. So just to give you a very brief overview of the findings, if we look at the entire history of Polish inequality since 1892, we found this very familiar U-shaped evolution of top income shares. Namely, inequalities were high before World War II, then they fall to very low levels between 1940s and 1980s, and then inequalities rose again after 1989. And actually, this is strikingly similar to the experience of Western countries. The only exception here is that this U-shape in Poland is much more pronounced, because our shocks were much more pronounced, much more radical than those in the West. Now, if we look at the last 30 years, just focus on the last period, we're going to see two big rises of inequalities. First, after 1989, typical transition story, but also we're going to see a strong rise after 2003, 2004, when Poland has joined the European Union. And in fact, if you look at the cumulative effect of these two big rises, within one generation, Poland has moved from being one of the most egalitarian countries in Europe to one of the most unequal countries in Europe. So it has experienced a profound change in social structure. And obviously, we are not the first ones looking at those at this topic. However, what's our contribution is that we are the first one to actually draw the long-run series of Polish inequality spanning the entire century. No one has done it before us. Moreover, we provide measures which are comparable both across time and countries. And also for the most recent period, we shed new light on the evolution of inequalities. So we use this new methodology where we correct household surveys with the tax data in order to arrive at better and more precise measures of income inequalities. And maybe just, so usually I speak about this in for Polish audience, but there's this very interesting paper by very obscure, completely forgotten economist, Jan Wiśniewski, in 1934. And he was talking about the biggest discovery when I was doing this research. So basically this guy in 1934 did distribution of national accounts for Poland. So something what now Thomas Piketty is doing for other countries. It was actually quite a surprise to see that even the 1930s, they had very similar ideas what we're having now. And he was then killed in World War II. So that's, you know, that's a sad story. Okay, so let me first talk about top income shares. Then I'm going to move to this, zoom into the more recent period and talk about the full income distribution. And at the end, I'll try to kind of maybe try to explain a little bit or give some ideas why we observe a growth, such a strong rise of inequality after the 1989. Okay, so let me start with some methodological notes. So when we want to measure inequality in the long run, we need to find a measure which has two features. First thing is that this measure must be comparable between periods. And second thing, this measure must be feasible to measure, right? And top income shares satisfy these both criteria. So first of all, we can construct top income shares even for the 19th century because we need just two informations to construct top income shares. We need to know what's the income of the richest people, okay? And the second thing was the total income in society. We don't need to know what's happening in the entire distribution of income. And from where do we get income of the richest? Usually we get this from the reports of the personal income tax. So whenever we see a country for which we can find some personal income tax, for that country we can usually construct top income shares. So in Poland, in the Polish case, the first personal income tax appears in 1892. As is no by accident, also the first starting point of our series. And then second thing, you must find some aggregate for the national income at the societal level. So you say you can get the, you know, let's say national income, and this has been estimated by many economists, and you can find a lot of estimates for the other periods as well. For instance, you know, the famous work by Madison provides a lot of useful estimates. But still, what we get, if we just relate, if we take the raw data, if we relate the income of the richest with the national income, what you're often going to find, let's say, is that for 1927, top 3% earned 5% of total income. And for 1928, top 4% earned, let's say, 6% of the income. Right? So it gets a number which is top 3% of the richest got something in 1 year, and top 4% of richest got something the next year. Right? These two measures are not comparable. Right? Because once we're talking about top 3%, but then we're talking about top 4%. So we must find a way to bring them to the same denominator, so again, to bring them to get the same measure. And for that we are using the fact that income of the richest follow the Pareto distribution. So from knowing that top 3% gets 5% of income, we can estimate what the share of income going to top 1% or top 5%. And we can do it for each and every year, and this way we're going to get homogeneous measure of inequality spanning the entire period. And of course, it sounds easy, but it's actually quite hard if you think that, you know, how many changes to the tax, you know, happened during this time and how many things happened. So, you know, it's actually the majority of the work in this methodology is to kind of homogenizing different concepts of income and different tax systems and so on. And to be more specific, when I talk about income, I mean this pre-tax, pre-social security contribution income. Okay, so this is the pre-redistribution kind of concept of income. And in terms of units, before 1945, I'm going to talk about households. So when I talk about top one, I mean top 1% of the richest households. After 1945, I'm talking about individuals. But in practice, it doesn't really matter in terms of this transition between these two periods.
Sorry, yeah. What do you mean by
composite? By composite, it means that, so what we do here is that we take, let's say you have a wife and a husband. So what we do here, we combine their income and divide by two between them. Okay. But then we don't treat them as separate individuals. but we're going to kind of share the income. So the idea is that, you know, often in the traditional societies, husband was the one earning income and the wife was sitting at home. But it wouldn't be fair to treat this the wife as a person having zero income, because she gets some income from husband, or as a kind of transfer for her domestic work. And so what's usually been done, so you combine the income and then divide by two.
I understand the methodology, but it does seem so strange to me as well to consider that she has had. But yeah, I understand. Pragmatically, I understand.
Yeah, so it means like, so basically, what we do with couple split, we are reducing inequality, right? Yeah. So if you just take the pure individual concept, you're going to have a lot of, in the traditional societies, right? I mean, like 70 years ago, we're going to have a lot of rich husbands. And then gonna have a lot of wives with zero income. It's indicative, depends what you're looking at. If you look at a gender inequality, that's of course, this is what you should look for. But if you look in terms of like, what do people have in terms of disposable income, I think it's better to do this couple split concept.
Okay.
But you can of course, I mean, I think it depends what you can research topic and which concept you should use. Actually, in my new work, we're doing this comparison for the 2000 for Poland. So it's just actually an interesting area to look at in terms of within household gender balance.
Yeah.
For your pre-tax measure, do you need to make any assumptions about the incidence of taxes other than income tax on the pre-tax? Do you need to make some assumptions about the incidence of taxes other than other than income tax?
Do you mean like VAT tax or
corporation tax? Yeah.
No. Here you just. No, basically. So you mean like what you would like to have? Let's say you would like to. So this is before any taxation, right? So this is what kind of what you get on your wage bill.
But that isn't truly before any taxation, because the amount that I receive, for example, mm-hmm. In income is still post corporation tax, for example, or VAT or other taxes. So, for example, what Pixie Zuckman and Sires do in the distributional mm-hmm. national accounts for the US is they have to make some assumptions about the incidence of corporation tax and so on when they estimate their pre-tax measure, and it turns out that makes quite a big difference. That they have this, if you've been on Twitter recently, it's kind of raging at the moment between Gabriel Zuckman and many other people, and a lot of that debate is about about the assumptions they make in the incidence of these other taxes.
So what you mean that in certain business incomes, pre-tax is basically post-tax.
Yeah, so business income would be the best example. If I'm receiving mm-hmm. dividends, then you can report the gross dividends as my pre-tax income, but it's not really pre-all taxes mm-hmm, because the dividends are paid mm-hmm. after corporation tax has been paid. So you want to make some assumption yeah. about who's bearing the incidence of yeah. that corporation tax.
Yeah, so in the Polish case, what we do, we rather exclude dividends from income of the richest, mostly because we don't observe this income, simply. And also the other thing in the Polish case, at least when it comes to dividends, they're very tiny. Actually, most of the dividends in Poland are just sent abroad. I think it's a good point, and I should probably think about more and definitely check my Twitter. writing about that's something to do. Okay.
So can I just lock in that a little bit? Are you going to tell us what the income sources are? I mean, you just say it doesn't include dividends. Is it going to include other capital incomes?
Yes. So in this case, when I think about income, I mean employee income, income from business sources. So like when you own a business, and income from capital gains, and income from rents, and income from, and I think that's it. And pensions, of course, and basic social transfers. but I don't capture here dividends, and I don't capture interest on your, let's say, saving accounts, unfortunately. But they are relatively small in the Polish case, that's for... And in, if anything, in some sense, what we argue in the paper is that they are heavily concentrated, dividends and interest. And so by excluding them, we're actually underestimating the inequality. So in some sense, we provide the we can think of it as a lower bound of the level of inequality, which is still extremely high. So you can kind of... But that's a very good point, Yes, so this is basically all the sources we used for constructing this. It's not just Polish one, but also Austrian, Prussian. Just one caveat for the communist time. So during the communist time, there was basically no personal income tax. So we don't have tax sources for the communist time. However, during the communist time, there was also no income from the private capital. So wage was basically the only income you got. So what for this reason, what we use the communist time, we use wage service, which will provide quite a good picture of the distribution of income during that time, because there was no income from other sources simply, and there was no personal income taxation. There are other things about communists, but I'm going to go back to this. Okay, so let me just show you the results. So these are top 1% income shares. So for instance, this dot here means that today, top 1% in Poland gets around 13.5% of total income, which places us at the top of the European League. But let me just briefly talk to you about describing what's happening here. So let's start from the late 19th century. So here we have data from the Austrian and the Prussian parts of Poland, which was a different countries back then. Unfortunately, we don't have data for the Russian part because there was no income tax then. But we can see that we have slowly growing inequality between 1892 and more or less World War I. And what we say in the paper, this is a classic cuisine story of industrialization. So we see these regions being industrialized, some very, these entrepreneurs and skilled workers are benefiting disproportionately more than the rest of the society, and that's why inequalities are rising, and especially in the urban areas. And in fact, if you go to this famous Kuznets theory, he built his theory on the Prussian data. So basically that's basically Kuznets' industrialization story. But that perhaps interesting here is that at least in the Prussian part of Poland, this was agricultural industrialization, somehow different from the classic one, where actually we see that agriculture is becoming more and more capital intensive with the introduction of, say, the beetroots, as a classical capital intensive plant. Now, let's now move to the World War I. I think that's a quite interesting period. So you see that, at least in the Prussian part, the top income shares are soaring. Actually, this is the highest point we report for Poland. This is time when top 1% got 20% of total income. And the reason for that is during the war, there was scarcity of food, so the food prices went up. And the Prussian part of Poland was heavily agriculture. There was this agriculture capitalism, as it was called. And so the high prices of food led to a huge profits of this what's called Junkers, so these huge landowners. And that's why we see that the top income shares are soaring. But then, eventually, the war came to these lands. So the destruction came to these lands, and then see instant fall. And so in some sense, this confirmation of this idea that wars are the great levelers. So in fact, you can see some rise of inequality during the wartime, but eventually, as war comes, you see that everything, the inequalities are disappearing. The next data point we have is 1924. We can already see that inequalities are at a much lower level in unified Poland. And in fact, this one result for that is because World War I. The other reason is because a lot of very nice progressive policies were introduced in the early 1920s. But actually, it started growing up quite quickly. In particular, what I think is interesting in the Polish case is the effect of the Great Crisis on inequality. So what happened in Poland, this is the nominal mean income indexed to 100 in 1925. This is for the whole country, and this is income of the richest groups. Okay? And what you can see is that the whole income during the Great Crisis has collapsed. So, and this was because, the agriculture prices went down, And since 60% of the Polish society was agriculture, farmers, the crisis disproportionately hit the 60% of the Polish society. At the same time, the urban bourgeois and business owners, they managed to protect their profits by creating cartels and monopolies. And so their income actually hasn't changed that much during the crisis. So basically, the inequalities rose during the crisis, not because income of the rich disappeared, because rich people managed to keep their profits intact, but the whole society suffered the big losses. So the denominator kind of fell significantly. So you can actually see, you know, while wars are these great levelers, actually crises may be the other way around, great unequalizers in this respect. Right, then we have 1939, we have under war, under big fall of inequality, but here in the Polish case, it's been reinforced by the introduction of communism. And communism has two important impacts on inequality. The first thing, we have introduction of the wage compression. So wages are no longer determined by the market, by your marginal productivity, instead by the decision of bureaucrats. And wage structure was used by politicians to control masses, basically. So whenever there was a turmoil in the society, we see wage compression. Inequalities are falling down. Whenever the society had problems with productivity, the central planners would widen the wage structure in order to provide more incentives. So basically, wage inequality in communist time is a story of turmoils and incentives. So actually, here if you look at wage inequality, so this is P9 to the median, you see a very similar evolution of us in the total income, but you see that there was a little bit more variation during the communist time. And in particular, you see the periods that inequalities are falling, exactly the periods where you have a lot of protests and strikes and so on. Actually, it was a political tool. Yeah.
Like going back to World War One, how much is the effect driven by migration, death, or like refugees? Can you control for that? Or?
Yeah, so one story could be that, let's say, poor people are more likely to go to war and die. And so basically you are wiping out poor people from society. It's not clear what's the effect of top income shares, because then the total income is falling down. And then you kind of, but then you're narrowing top 1%, right? So, but anyway, what we found in the papers, actually, you see that literally the income of the richest has been going up. It wasn't just the denominator of total income would change, but you actually see that those guys at the top, the income were increasing, right? So in this respect, we think it's more about simply this, there was a blockade on Germany. So Germany could, there was a ban on export of foods to Germany, and we think it's mostly this was causing the rise of top income shares. Because if this was something about migration, killings and so on, you will see more action happening with the income denominator, with total income rather than income of the richest. But yeah, I mean, we don't have micro-level data, we have just some time series and it's more narration, so we kind of think this is more likely what happened, but this is not causal, of course, and we don't. Okay, so then, so this was one thing that the communist time, was the compression of the wage structure. Second important thing was basically de facto elimination of income from private sources. So people could have very small businesses, such as kiosk or like little vegetable shop, but they couldn't own a company or factory. So that you don't have this kind of income. And of course, this is a great aggregate equalizer. And you see that top income shares are falling to around 4% and they've been stagnant for around 40 years. Then we have capitalism coming back in 1989. We have instant adjustment, instant rise of inequality, in early 90s, and the second one after 2004, when Poland joined the European Union. A huge rise. And I'm going to come back to this. How do we compare to other countries? So this is the Western world. This is Germany, France, UK, Sweden. Everywhere you see this familiar U-shaped evolution of top income shares throughout the century. But in the Polish case, these are the black dots, you see that this U-shape is much more pronounced because more radical shocks. Interestingly, you can see that we move In 1989, our top income threats were the lowest. Now, they're at the level of Germany and UK, way above what's happening in Sweden or France. Now, if we compare ourselves to other Central Eastern European countries, in this case to Czechoslovakia, slash Czechs, Russia, and Hungary, you see that actually all those countries experienced a similar low level of top income share during the communist time. But then what I think is really interesting, as someone explored, is completely different trajectories of top income shares after the transition. So at the lower end, we have Hungary and Czechs, with relatively low rise of inequality. Then we have Poland, which experienced high rise of inequality. And then we have Russia, which basically exploded. And today, Russia is at the level of more or less US. And just maybe on a positive note, we also calculated gender wage gap. So this is the relationship between female and male median. And we see that actually there's something which has been constantly improving throughout the history, just to have some positive information here. Okay, so this was kind of like a big picture, you know, if you look at inequality across the whole 20th century. Now let me just maybe talk more about the last 30 years, which I think is extremely important for me personally because I was born then, but also I think in general we can learn a lot about the effect of economic growth on inequality. So here what we like to have is some more comprehensive measure of inequality. Let's say you want to know not just what's happening to the top 1%, but what's happening to the bottom 50%, middle 40%, and top 10%. This is much harder because for that we need to have information about the entire distribution of income, right? And usually what people have been using are the household surveys. But the problem with the household surveys is that they tend to underreport income of the richest. First, because very rich people are unlikely to end up in the random sample, simply by, you must be very lucky to have a rich person in your sample. Second thing, because people tend to underreport their income. And in effect, if you look actually in the Polish case, if you look at EU Silk, which is probably the best data we have in Poland right now for in terms of household surveys, and if you calculate the weighted sum of business income, so calculate total business income, you're going to find a number which is 50% of what's being reported in national accounts. So surveys are extremely poor at capturing business income and income of the richest. However, at the same time, we still have tax data, which provides a quite good picture of income of the richest. So the idea here is that let's take survey and describe what's happening, let's say, between the 0 percentile and the 90 percentile. And let's use tax data to explain what's happening between the 90 percentile and the richest person. Right? So let's use advantage of these two data and combine them together. That's the basic idea. And thanks to that, we can actually construct also these other measures, such as bottom 50% or mid 40%. And here, similarly, what we do this is before taxation. We do this, we do a couple split. We use HBS and USILC, adjusted for the income of the richest. Okay, so this is the graph. This is what we got, right? So here we have income share of the top 10%, middle 40%, and bottom 50%. So let me start from the end of communism. Top 10% is capturing around 22-23% of total income. Bottom 50% gets 31%, and the middle class gets 46%. Now let's move fast forward. Today, top 10% gets around 35% of total income, bottom 50 gets around 24%, and the share of middle class went down to 40%. Right, so we move from the society where top 10% was getting less than either bottom 50 or mid 40, to society where top 10% gets much more than bottom 50%, and actually relatively close to what's being given to middle 40%. And you can see these two periods of growth here, the early 90s, and then more or less after 2003. And in fact, Poland has moved within one generation, talking about 30 years, from being one of the most egalitarian countries in Europe to being one of the most unequal countries in Europe. Okay? And this is how Gini looks. So this is the black line. And you can see very similar development, very strong rate of Gini in two periods. Interestingly, so this is Gini calculated on the corrected survey data. So here we combine surveys with tax data. This is what you get if you only use surveys, if you ignore the income of the richest. You get much lower level of inequality, and you don't see any rise after 2000. And this number is still being reported by the Polish Statistical Office. And you know, whenever I speak to journalists, they say, oh, but inequalities are low and they're not changing in Poland. But all, they're all based on these old school measures, which I think are fundamentally wrong. And I think it's the same case in the UK. And certainly I read that actually ONS is now slightly moving to these measures of inequality. They notice that there's something wrong with the surveys. Okay, how do Poland compare to other countries? And I think here the story is bittersweet. So let me start with the sweet part. So this is the bottom 50% in Poland, Russia, France, and China. So let me compare Poland to Russia here. So at the end of communism, bottom 50% got more or less the same share in Russia and Poland. Now comes the transition. The bottom 50% in Poland experienced a steady decline to 24%. But what happens in Russia is a tragedy. The bottom 50% went down from around 30% in 1990 to less than 10% in 1996. So within 5 years, the income of the bottom 50% disappeared in Russia. And we're going to kind of come back to this, trying to explain what happened, what was the difference between Poland and Russia here. And what we argue is because of social transfers. So we, in Poland, we created quite a good safety net. For instance, pensions were indexed for inflation. Whereas in Russia, pensions were not indexed for inflation. So when hyperinflation struck the country in the early 90s, the income of the poor disappeared. Right? So in some sense, you know, I'm talking about the rise of inequality, but I think there's also a lot of success story in terms of inequality. Now comes the bitter part. This top 10% again, Russia, China, Poland, and France. And let's compare Poland to France. In the 80s, of course, top 10% in France was much higher than in Poland because France was a capitalistic country. But it was enough, 15 years was more enough for Polish top 10% to take over the French top 10%, right? So within like 15 years, we managed to kind of be more capitalistic than the France has been. And you can see this parallel shock to top 10% in Russia, which was just skyrocketing within a few years. And you know, going back to the first question, is who has benefited from economic growth in Poland? This is kind of like a table version of the famous growth incidence curve popularized by Branko Milanović. So here we see the total cumulative growth in Poland between 1989 and 2015. So the average growth, average income, has risen by 73% between 1989 and 2015. That's a very strong and healthy rise. In France, in slightly longer period, it was 35%. In Russia, it was 41%. But now the question is, what fraction of this economic growth actually ended up in the bottom 50% of the population? And you can see that in Polish case, the half of the society experienced growth of only 31% in this period, right? So half of what's being reported as a national average. In France, it was actually the same, but you know, if you compare this number to this one, you can see that actually the bottom 50% experienced more or less the same growth as the average. In Russia, actually, their income has declined by minus 20%. Now, if you look at middle class, we get number 47%. If you look at top 10%, you get number 200%, top 1, 160%, top promile, 1,000%. In Russia, you get similar numbers, in France, just 100%. Right? So if you take this, you know, if you take this Poland as a growth champion, the spectacular economic growth, actually, you can see that 90% of the Polish society hasn't experienced that growth. In fact, the experienced growth is much smaller than this. So maybe, you know, it's not a surprise that although we have this wonderful economic growth, we still have, you know, the return of the very populist politicians in Poland and, you know, very strong growth, or this redistribution policies. And just maybe one additional fact about who are the richest in Poland now. But I think it's quite interesting in the Polish case, is that most of the people from top 1% are business owners. And you can see that the share of business owners has been growing. So when you think about top income shares in the US or Western world, we usually think about CEOs, managers, and so on. In Poland, it's more about, you know, these homegrown entrepreneurs taking over the richer spheres. And I think it's quite similar, I think, in Germany, if I'm not mistaken. Yes?
So this is the tax data.
Yeah.
So I had a question, because earlier you were talking about the fact that the household survey is only capturing like 50% of all of the business income compared to national accounts.
Mm-hmm.
So if you would compare it to this, do you see that over time this 50% is an average, so does it go down?
I haven't checked that.
Okay.
I think it's quite volatile. I really think it is my opinion when I was looking at EUC, that I think it's just like the income and business income in EUC, I think it's rubbish. Like, it just changes from one year to another one. It's just, I don't think it's really, like, yeah, but. Yeah.
So then compared to the tax data, how much business income do you capture compared to the national accounts? Have you looked at that?
So this is, the national account data is based, so here, national accounts of data is based on the tax data.
Okay.
Right, so basically, the assumption is like what you actually being this is the income we've been reported in Poland, right? So we know the total income reported from the tax reports. Okay, so we know that let's say can give you an even precise number, like 180 billions of Polish zloty were reported in to tax authorities, right? And so this is actually the problem with tax data is you cannot really you see just aggregate and you know what was given to let's say top 1%. What was earned by top 1%, right? So you cannot kind of take this income and distribute it to the other parts of society. If you take EU Silk, you're going to get a number which is around 80 billion, so half of this amount.
Like the reason I ask, because actually I find for the UK that there is a difference, at least in the investment income reported in the tax data and the national accounts household sector. So there are discrepancies there, so this is not really completely always clear to how that works.
I think it really depends. I don't know in details like how national accounts are being constructed in different countries. I'm not sure. Maybe they use different sources in the UK. In Poland, they usually use the tax data to kind of get the national aggregate for, let's say, different sources, because I don't think they have any other data source for that, to be honest.
Okay.
They have registries. But in the UK, maybe they have better registries, so maybe the differences come from. And I don't know, honestly, why.
Okay.
But we can talk later.
Yeah.
I'm happy to learn more about that. The UK case. All right, so just to wrap up the evolution of inequality, so we see an immediate upward adjustment of inequality after the fall of socialism and a strong increase after 2003-2004, after Poland joined the European Union. We see steady fall of the bottom 50% and the middle class, which is, you know, it's not like this middle class was kind of getting something more than bottom 50%. Their share just kind of declined in the same way. We see that domination of capital among income of the richest. And if you compare ourselves to, if you compare Poland to other countries, we see that we are more unequal than any other countries in the European Union, but we are way below Russia and the US. So now I try to kind of maybe explain a bit how much time do I have?
About 10 minutes.
Okay,
15
cool.
Minutes. We'll finish by 1:45 for sure. So,
okay.
Finish at 1:30 for questions. That'd be good.
So now, a few more words. What explains this rise of inequality after 1989? And if we take this very general view on inequality, and this is the composition of income inequality coming from Matheson and Sherrox, you can kind of, and if you decompose variants of inequality between components related to capital and labor, you can say that the total inequality will depend on the inequality of labor income, right? So the higher inequality between wage earners, the higher overall inequalities. Inequalities of the capital income, so between business owners. And then the relative importance of capital versus labor income, right? So let's say we know that inequality of capital income is much more capital income is much more concentrated than labor income. So if we move income from labor to capital, inequalities will rise. If we move income from one category, which is relatively equal, to the other category, which is relatively more unequal. Okay? So basically, the total evolution of income will be a function of these three things: so inequality within labor, inequality within capital, and basically capital share. So inequalities between these two sources. At the end, there will be also an effect of the covariance between capital owners and wage earners. Right. So there's a different situation if the highest wage earner is also the highest, the richest business owner, versus a situation where these two people are different personas. What I'm going to talk now are just these three elements. And I'm going to argue that the rise of inequality of labor income and the rise of inequality of capital income, both of them explain pretty well what happened in the early 90s. But if you want to understand what happened after 2003 in Poland, you must point to the capital share and labor share. And that's the main factor. But I'm not going to talk about the last component because we don't know about this yet. Okay. So inequality of labor income, right? So in other words, wage inequality. What is shaping wage inequality in the Polish case? We think that it's all about institutions and policies. Right? We're not going to talk about technology here. I don't think it's relevant in the Polish case. I think it's all about institutions and policies. In particular, huge shocks which happened in the early 90s, which is liberalization of wage setting process, creation of minimum wage and safety net, and the decline of unions. And let me just show you a few slides on that. So first, the most obvious and the most radical change was liberalization of the wage setting process. So again, during the communist time, wages were determined centrally by some bureaucrats. Now suddenly, wages are determined by the market. So of course, you know, people with higher education were going to earn more. People with lower education will start earning less. And this was coming from two sources. First of all, workers were moving to new private sector, so people start creating companies. Workers move from the state-owned companies to the new private companies, where they experience the market wage structure. In addition, you can also see that even within state-owned companies, the people will start using market wages for their remuneration. And this is a graph from a paper by Kane Prasad showing the returns to education in Poland around this time. So this is wage gap basically between college-educated workers, some college, high school, and basic vocational in relationship to elementary education. And you can see that basically there was some premium from education during the communist time, but it wasn't that big. And it was pretty stable. Then the communist collapses, and you see that this is all lines diverging, right? So you see strong rise of the educational premium from 38% to nearly 70%. You see the rise of high school and some college, and the stagnation of lower educational levels, right? So this kind of, this was a big, profound change on the whole wage structure. At the same time, and I think that's kind of a positive story, going back to this comparison with Russia, Poland quickly introduced a set of pretty good, well-designed social policies. And I think minimum wage is it's a good example here. So this is minimum wage in relationship to the average wage, which is 100, right? And this was the effect, you can see the evolution here, and there was a big fall in the minimum wage in Poland at the end of the 80s because at that time minimum wage was not indexed for inflation. So when inflation struck, the average wage went up because the inflation went up, but then minimum wage remained the same in nominal terms. And of course, the relationship between minimum wage and average wage collapsed. But later on, they introduced indexation for inflation, and you see that actually minimum wage is rising, and it kind of stabilizes, and it's actually been growing since then. Whereas in Russia, what happened is that they actually had relatively generous minimum wage at the end of the 80s, but again, they didn't index it for inflation in the early 90s. And so what happened is basically that minimum wage went almost down to zero in the 90s and kind of remained on a similar level. But that's one, yeah.
Do you know how much of it was like kind of due to like recession or economic downturn versus kind of protection of wages, really? Like,
You mean the minimum wage?
Yeah, kind of, you know, the denominator of, you know, kind of the inequality, the riches to the to the average, like how much was driven by economic downturn or just policies, essentially?
So I think in the early years, it was probably to some extent driven by by the downturn, and you can just go back all the way to the beginning. Disappear? Do you have some time limit set? I just here, maybe we can just. Anyway, so you see that income was falling in the early 90s, but it quickly kind of, especially in Poland, Poland was in heavy recession at the end of the 80s and the 80s. But there was a little bit like downturn, but it quickly kind of went up, and you see that the economic growth in the early 90s was quite strong.
Right.
So there was no big recession. There was just one year or 2 year shock. In Russia, probably it was more complicated than this, and maybe that partly explains why you see top income just soaring at that time.
Is this on a USB stick?
No.
Or is it on the computer? Because has the USB just been dislodged?
Oh. I thought it was copied into. Anyway, so we continue speaking. And on the next graph, yeah.
So while we're waiting for that, I wanted to ask you about this. You starting in 1989. So that's the, in your data, that's the year of the big dip. Is that right? And if so, I wonder if it actually would be more useful, more meaningful to tell us about the growth rates following, starting in the year.
So actually the big dip was in 1990, 1991.
Okay, great.
Actually, 89 was here, was at the top of this wave. Oh. And then you see the fall, and the strong rise afterwards.
Okay, great. So, and you see the same in the incomes that you're measuring, the household incomes that you're measuring, right? That they don't, there's a dip from 1990, but not 1990.
Yeah, so if you do this, like, this growth incidence curve from 1990, you will see the rise of income of more than 100%. But we see kind of from 90, but the thing is, you know, this kind of with adjustment, you know, it's supposed to go like this. Oh, that's something else. Okay. It's a different one. Okay. And it was the same story if you look at the share of transfers in Poland at the time. You see that it was relatively healthy. And so this is the share of transfers in the bottom, 50%. This is in the middle, 40% in 1986 until today, and its share has been growing and steady. So if anything, I think the creation of minimum wage and safety net have protected the bottom of the poorest in Poland around the transition, which did not happen in Russia. Other interesting stuff which I think has been pretty unexplored is the role of unions. So here you can see, why is it so small? Here you can see the union density in Poland and the other four countries, Czech Republic, Hungary, Germany, and top 1% income shares. And what you can see is the striking kind of mirror, that the two are mirroring each other. And you know, this is kind of, you know, one can say you have different scales here, but if you actually run the regression, and you run first difference regression on top income shares only, you're going to find a very strong and negative correlation between the two. In my opinion, what's happening here is that the decline of unions in Poland allowed very high salaries to be paid in the corporate sector. So thanks to the fact that we no longer have unions, those managers could be paid enormous amount of money. But this is something, I mean, this is more like hypothesis, something to kind of be explored in the future. Yeah.
Right, because kind of globalization could also play an important role in top income shares. Right?
Yeah, I'm going to come back to this in a minute. So this is still inequality of wage income in some sense, right? When it comes to, and I think this is very important to explain what happened in the early 90s, however, I don't think inequality of labor income can explain what happened after 2003. And the same with inequality of capital income. So again, in the communist time, we had no private sector, basically. So we have new sector being created. We have privatization. And of course, inequality of capital income has been growing. But actually, it's been shown that it's quite important before 94, but not really afterwards. And what we also show that after 2000, inequality of business income has been remarkably stable. So it hasn't changed much there. So actually, if you want to understand, and this is our claim, if you want to understand what happened to Polish top income shares, income inequality, after 2003, after Poland has joined the European Union, I think you must look at capital share. So what fraction of income goes to business sources and capital sources? So here we can have capital share in Poland, that's the white series, compared with top 1% income share. And there's been huge increase in capital share. So this is 1995, 2015. In the 90s, it was around 24%, so something we know, with what we know from the UK or Western countries. And within a few years, after 2000, it went up to nearly 40%. And in fact, if you look at Karabarbuni, it's a name on database of capital share, Poland was one of the largest increases in capital share in the last 15 years. And you can see that top income shares are kind of following with certain lag this development. And what's even more striking, if you compare, if you do the same thing, but if you pick the German capital share, that's this line, and you compare German capital share, the top 1% in Poland and Germany, see that after 2000, these lines are kind of strikingly similar. The evolution is kind of almost the same. Yeah.
So on the previous slide, to have such an enormous rise in capital share, that must imply either that there was really huge growth and all that was in capital, or that the absolute amount of labour income must have gone down quite substantially in those few years. So what combination is going on there?
I believe it's the first one. I mean, you must remember that during this time we have very strong economic growth in Poland. Like, it's the pie has been growing steadily, so it's more that capital pie, the portion of pie going to capital has been growing much faster than the portion of pie going to labour.
But that's like, it must, I mean, you just do the calculation, I can't do it in my head, but it must
be. No, it's massive growth
over 5 years.
Yes.
I mean, do you think there could be some element of sorting going on here? Because another potential story is that you've got a hollowing out of your labour share from a lot of high-earning people migrating out of Poland. I mean, if you look at it from the UK perspective, then that seems like a possible...
Yes, so that's one hypothesis we have here that could be... but then actually, if anything... So the one story could be low income, low wage, and low skilled workers moved to UK after 2004, which implied the rise of wages in Poland. And as long as labor and capital are substitutes, that would imply shift towards capital, because now labor is more expensive in Poland. That would be one explanation. So for this story to make sense, there must be a connection between the migration and wages in Poland, right? So there must be, with more migration, we see the increase of wages in Poland because of there's less and less labor. All people went to UK. What I think Christian Dussmann has one paper showing that there's no effect on wages, which for me, it kind of suggests that it's probably not the main channel. It probably plays a role, but I think the more important ones, and I'm going to talk about this in a second. Yeah.
Also, in relation to what you're saying, it looks like this massive increase in capital share actually happened prior to 2004, looking at your graph.
Yeah. So there's certain lag here. So here, you see actually there's a difference between 1 and 2 years between the rise of capital share and top income shares. But actually, if you use another measures, you're going to see that these two lines are perfectly overlap. I think, there's probably... So there's one thing to remember here. So when we're talking about capital share, we're talking about the whole income generated in the country. This income can go to Polish people and may also go to foreign owners of companies in Poland, right? And so this rise of capital share doesn't automatically imply the rise of Polish incomes, because all this income can go, let's say, to France or Germany. So, but then these two will be connected if there are strong linkages, let's say, between foreign-owned companies and the Polish-owned companies. So there's like no automatic kind of, they shouldn't, in theory, they shouldn't kind of go together at the same time.
Absolutely. what I meant more is that if that's the kind of timeline we're working with, it would suggest that it's not, it doesn't have that much to do with people who emigrating after 2004. Like, and it looks like that happened prior to that, and therefore, yeah, but because of, like, the, you know, the Holy Act or the like,
It also depends which measure you use, because if you use some other measures of capitalization, it's a big debate on which one is better. You see that it's more like, it happens more over 2003-04 and here. But again, I think there's no convincing story for me why would migration lead to such a big rise. And I think good that you're asking about this, because I think the main reason of this are FDA technology change, simply. And so I can show you the details if you want, but I kind of been going through different arguments what may cause this rise of capital share. And the one is simply saying that maybe the workers' bargaining power has been declining, but in my other paper with David Soskis and Steve Manchin, we are showing that actually in Poland, rent sharing hasn't declined. It's the only country in Europe for which we don't report the decline of rent sharing. Also, one argument could be globalization. Let's say we have import competition from China, and in Poland we have traditional labor-intensive industries such as textile industry, and so those industries must now compete with China, so they decline, and so we move reallocate economic activity, let's say, to capital-intensive car manufacturing sectors, right? So it's kind of reallocation story, and what we show is that also not really the case in Poland. You cannot explain changes in capital share by any reallocation arguments. What we think is probably the main drives of capital share in Poland are FDI. So FDI, which were very strong in the early 2000s, they make a broad capital intensive technology to Poland, right? So there's say Opel is building a factory in Poland, and it brings all those machines and robots and so on. And this by itself shouldn't explain the rise of top income shares, because these are still German monies. This is German income, right, being produced in Poland. But there must be also some kind of linkage between this foreign sector in Poland and the domestic sector. And we saw that actually there's a very strong connection between these two in the Dustin papers. Actually, there's sectors which experience a lot of FDIs are also sectors which have very strong domestic linkages across companies. Another story is, of course, also that maybe it was all about technological change. You know, the Polish companies introducing a lot of technology. And in fact, there's been a recent report by EBRD saying that Poland is way ahead of the curve in terms of numbers of robots used in manufacturing. So personally, I believe this is probably the most likely story for Poland for such a rise of capital share. But of course, there are other stories as well.
Pavel, you like to wrap up in a couple of minutes?
I'm finishing.
A few questions at the end.
So to wrap up, I think the rise of inequality within labor and capital explain what happened in the early 90s, whereas the rise of capital share explain what happened after 2003. I think this is all about institutions and policies. I think this is all about technology and maybe a little bit of globalization. Right, and I think in some sense the conclusion that institutions are crucial is in some optimistic here, right? So we show that we have communism, we have a big fall in top income shares. We have early 90s, we have set of policies, and they have big effect of top income shares. I think it's a positive message because it means that we can control and tame inequality by setting a good and proper institutions. And of course, I think what's really interesting is what happened in Poland after 2003, such a strong rise of inequality. But I think it's less about institutions, more about market forces, such as globalization, technological change. I think it's still pretty much open question, and my future projects are going to go into this direction as well. But still, I think with certain policies, you can actually also tame those forces as well and kind of use them to produce more equal society. But thank you.